Gentlemen, welcome once again to another edition of the Adonis Lifestyle Podcast. I am Brad Howard, and I've got John Barbin on the phone once again, and we've got some interesting stuff we want to talk about today. But first, a lot of guys are asking and writing in saying, where can we get the Adonis Index Systems and stuff like that? It's really easy. Just go to AdonisIndexSystems.com. It will take you to the page where you can order them if you want them. And we'll get you taken care of right then, get in the forums, interact with us, and get you some results. So, John, what's the deal? I know we wanted to talk about a little bit of water and water weight and things like that. We kind of talked about that at the end of the last podcast. We also you want to talk about separating some signal from noise, and then also some clinical significance versus real-world significance. All of these things are pretty big. So let's start up with the water thing, because you've got some good ideas about some things that people really need to hear.
All right, so let's get started here. Water, when we're talking about water, we're not talking about bottled water or water coming out of the tap. We're talking about water weight and where water is stored and distributed around your body. So when it comes to this whole, the way your body looks and how heavy you are on the scale and whether or not you're gaining or losing fat or gaining or losing muscle, all of that is confounded by water. And in reality, you're really just talking about where you're in, at least in some respects, you're talking about where you're pushing water around on your body. So muscle mass, like gaining muscle, for example, a muscle is like 85%, or it's a really high percentage of water. When you gain muscle, you're not technically gaining strands and strands of protein the way I think a lot of guys think about it. Like they think they're laying down this like very tangible, like just protein, like actual like you know bricks of protein. Really, what you're doing is like filling a water balloon, and just picture the balloon, the rubber of the balloon, as being the protein of your muscle. That doesn't really go up much. It's just the water content inside the balloon that's becoming more full, I guess, more bloated. And so that's kind of the concept of building muscle. So it's not really building, like laying a brick on top of a brick. It's actually just filling a balloon bigger. That's more how you would look at it. And that's largely an effect of, at least to some degree, water. Same with weight loss. There's a confounding, and this will make sense where we get into the separating the signal from the noise. When we eat any food, especially carbohydrate type foods like grains and pastas and all that kind of stuff, there's two things. There's an inflammatory response to eating, and there's the food itself has water, and then there's a water retention response too. So when you eat, the water content of your body is like totally tied to the amount of food you eat, how often you eat. So if you're constantly eating and you're eating a lot of calories, that doesn't – I mean part of it is you're going to be gaining weight if you're eating too much, but also part of it is you're holding a lot of water, you're retaining water, and you're in a kind of a sort of a steady, constant, inflamed state. So that's partly why really big people who go on a calorie-reduced diet – drop like a lot of weight all at once. You'll hear stories about people dropping like 10 pounds in a week or like 20 pounds in a month, and it sounds like ridiculously high. But that's because they're just reducing that inflammatory response, and they're finally dropping away a lot of that extra water retention because they're finally eating less food for the first time. So it doesn't mean they're burning 20 pounds of fat off. It means, you know, they may have burnt 5 or 6 pounds of fat and reduced 14 pounds of water retention and inflammation. So that's part of the signal and the noise. That's part of not realizing that it's not just fat. It's a lot to do with the way your body holds water. Now, girls would probably get this better than guys because some girls go through a pretty pronounced monthly cycle where they get it. They get the days when they're bloated and they're holding water, and they just tell. They know that they're going to be 3-4 pounds heavier for a few days or a week or whatever. But guys don't really – we're not as in tune to that kind of thing. But I'm sure – we all know how bloated we can get after eating a lot, you know, big dinner. Like, well, I mean, Thanksgiving dinner for everyone in the States anyways. I mean, part of that is the actual food mass, but part of it's the water that comes with it and the way it changes the way your body holds water. So the water compartment thing is something people aren't paying attention to when they're looking at the look and shape of their body and they're changing their body.
Okay. Gotcha. So I guess what we could say is that, you know, one of the things that I don't know, I kind of left off with at the end of the last podcast was the fact that, you know, you'll hear a lot of people say, you know, I lost 10 pounds, you know, on such and such diet, and then, you know, such and such guru comes across and says, well, you know, so what? It's just water weight. And kind of what I'm getting from this is that instead of that being a bad thing, it's actually kind of a good thing at the same time.
Sure. Who wants to be 10 pounds heavier all bloated with water? I mean, that does you no good. Because beyond all of this, everyone's just wants to look better because, I mean, you know, I don't know if that's, you know, whoever says they're working out for health, yeah, whatever. I mean, I'm sure there's a health benefit that comes along with exercising and eating, quote, right, or whatever you want to call it. But none of us would do this if we didn't look any better. Like, would anyone actually exercise and diet and do all that if it made you technically healthier, but, like, you know, 30 pounds fatter and look sloppy and you would actually be weaker? Like, who would actually exercise or diet if you looked worse? So let's just get that on the table, that everyone's doing this to look better. And then inadvertently, health is a side effect of good looks, because, or a good-looking body, because, you know, I've never heard of a body that looks good that also isn't healthy. So it kind of it works out nicely that they fit together. So yeah, getting rid of some water, there's nothing wrong with getting rid of water. I mean, when people say, well, that's just water, that's part of the whole point. You mean that's what a smaller body has less water on it. So I don't know anyone who would actually choose to just have more water. So that's right. That's one of the effects. And that's an issue that people maybe not are realizing, that bodybuilders towards the end of a show, towards the end of a diet, towards their competition, the thing that wins or loses the show for most bodybuilders is how they manipulate and deal with their water. And a lot of people, I don't think, realize that the last couple of days before the show is when they do pretty interesting things and creative stuff to try to get rid of the water on their body. Now, a lot of them just take diuretics, like really hardcore diuretics that you can't find over the counter. They're pharmaceuticals, and they're typically injectables. And, you know, if you just inject a little too much of them, you could just stop your heart. So, and that's happened. There's pretty well documented cases of bodybuilders who've killed themselves with diuretics. Eventually the Bodybuilding Federation, the IFBB, had to actually kind of crack down on the diuretics because it was way too easy for people to kill themselves with them. And since they were being judged on how ripped they got, it was a bit of a hypocritical situation. You had to be ripped, and being ripped in that kind of bodybuilding was meant being super dry, like dry meaning having very little water, like using diuretics. So on one hand, you're awarding the top prize to the guy who's using the most diuretics, and on the other hand, you're saying, well, but we got to regulate them because these guys are killing themselves because they're trying to get too ripped. So it came to a head, I think, in the early to mid-90s, I think it was. There was guys who were just getting ridiculously dry. Like they were using so much diuretics, and you could just tell. And those were the guys who ended up killing themselves. So, mm-hmm. I mean, it was pretty obvious. You could look through the magazines, point out the guy who seemed to be the driest, and then, you know, lo and behold, a couple of years later, you find out, you hear the news about his death due to diuretics. So mm-hmm. that's when they cracked down. So, but bringing this back full circle to most people listening here, and you and I are never going to compete bodybuilding, but that look of being really lean and seeing all six of your abs plus all the oblique, those weird muscles on the side and like little crevices like everywhere, that's a dehydrated look. That's a look that few people ever have. And bodybuilders have that look for like the day of the show, just for a few hours. That look does not persist. Now, again, you and I and everyone probably knows a couple people who seem to be like very tight skin, sort of have that dry look sort of all the time. There are a few people that are like that, but that's not the mean. Most people don't have that tight of a look on a regular basis. So to try to achieve that look is, I guess I'm trying to say you got to be realistic with the look you're chasing, and because you could be in chase mode forever and be wondering why you're not getting there and why you're not getting there. And that's because it's not normal to be that tight and that dry all the time. So, so the fitness industry, people don't realize that a lot of the images they're seeing are from that kind of look. They're seeing people, cover models and stuff that you may not think at all or have been using diuretics just to be in that shape, but they have. And they've done like water manipulation. They've done the last, you know, 24 hours before the show, they stop drinking water, which is totally routine. They'll stop intaking water as well as use a diuretic. And then some people will drop 10 to 12 pounds, guys and girls, in the last 24 hours before a show. And that's just normal. That's just how it works. So, you know, whatever they look like on stage, just realize that just a day before, they were 10 pounds heavier than that, and it was all water. So that makes a drastic change in the way people look. And that's, you know, that could be, from what I can tell and the type of questions I keep getting about, like, you know, gaining and losing weight and the look and different things like that, it seems most people's questions, I don't think they realize what they're actually asking is a difference just between water fluctuations. Like, I don't think people realize how big of a deal water has on the way you'll actually look. So it's, you know, people go up and down 4 or 5 pounds a day, like I do routinely, depending on just how much food I've eaten. And I know that doesn't mean I've gained 4 or 5 pounds of fat. That just means there's probably 2 or 3 pounds of food itself. Now it's, after I eat it, it's just sitting in me. And then with an associated increase in, like, if I'm drinking water, I'm not expelling as much because, you know, part of the effect of the food is to keep water in instead of getting rid of it. But then if I do a fast, all the water goes, all the food goes, and then there's your true weight. So that's part of to try to get your true body measurement, you kind of have to be in a fasted state. Otherwise, you're measuring some water retention and some food that's just kind of sitting around in you.
Gotcha. So, yeah, I mean, it's kind of interesting how quickly I know I've, you know, dropped, well, all of us. I mean, I'm not going to say all of us, but I mean, those of us that indulge from time to time in the alcoholic beverages. I mean, if you go overboard or you have a weekend or a spring break or something like that, I mean, I know I can go 10 pounds easily in dropping weight over the weekend. Just from being dehydrated or just drinking a lot and stuff like that. And then, you know, you take that and then you couple the effects of creatine at the same thing where, you know, as soon as I start taking creatine or whatever, my body weight will go up by 5 to 7 pounds, you know, within a couple of days. So same thing.
And that as creatine gets absorbed into your muscle cells, there's an associated increase of water in your muscle cell that the creatine sort of pulls in there with it. Or, you know, that's the simple explanation, but basically that's what happens. I have a good example. A guy I was training. He was a really big guy, and he was on a cut down. Dude, move your move the part of your headset a little bit away because I can hear you breathing. Hmm. Move it up a bit. Anyway, so this guy I was training, he was his measurement day was Thursday mornings because his eating routine throughout the week was very consistent from Sunday night till Friday. So Thursday was about as consistent and as accurate of a weekly measurement as he could take. And so one week he went to a barbecue with some friends and just, you know, drank whatever he wanted to drink and ate burgers and stuff. He went up 11 pounds on Sunday, just Sunday. So that doesn't mean he gained 11 pounds of fat. That just means he probably ate about 6 or 7 pounds of food and drank another, you know, 3 or 4 pounds of beer and didn't really get rid of much of it. And so by the end of the day, he was just 11 pounds heavier for that day. Now, by the time he hit Thursday, he was down a pound from the Thursday before. So remember, Thursday to Thursday is his like actual measurement on his cut down. So on the Thursday before he was, you know, 232 pounds. And then the Thursday afterwards, he was 231, measuring himself in the exact same state Thursday to Thursday, because he takes the whole week. He eats, he has a very consistent eating pattern throughout the week, but he had an 11-pound increase just on Sunday. So that just shows you how much different you can be day to day based on how much food you ate. Like me and some friends went out for some sushi on Friday, and man, we're 5 or 6 pounds heavier after that, after all you can eat sushi. But, you know, I'm already back down 4 of those pounds. So it's just a transient increase in food mass and water. And I'm just trying to get – I don't know if we've beat that to death like we usually do, but that's basically if you're measuring anything, your measurement day has to be – like measuring by like your body weight or anything like that. Your measurement day has to be very consistent. Otherwise, you'll be all messed up looking at the scale and seeing how much you change in water, unless you want to see how much you change from meal to meal and moment to moment throughout the day. Then go ahead, jump on the scale like 5 or 6 times a day, and you'll see your body weight's all over the place based on how much you've fluids you've consumed and how much you've eaten.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. So, you know, kind of goes back into the whole, you know, credence of, even though hitting the scale is kind of important on a week by week basis to measure kind of global changes, you know, the measurements are really where it's at.
Yeah, and consistency of measurement. So, I guess this leads into separating the signal from the. Was that a good enough understanding of water? Like, do we get a point, or do we need a take-home message before we move on? At least as far as like the effect of water, do you think we got it?
Well, I think that it will definitely help a lot of people understand the difference between low-carb diets and high-carb diets, or higher-carb diets and things like that. Why people tend to drop more weight on low-carb. What is it that a gram of glycogen, you know, pulls in what, you know, 2.2 grams of water or something like that. So, you know, the less, you know, glycogen / the carbohydrates you have in you, obviously it's not going to pull as much water in. So, so that's one effect. I mean, things like that. I mean, that might be some things to really touch on really quickly. I just kind of take it that direction and kind of, because we're getting questions about that type of thing too.
Yeah. A lot of people report a huge weight loss in the first week or so of going on a low carb diet. And that's not because they're dropping fat. That's because they're, for the first time probably in their lives, they're not consuming a mass amount of carbs like on a daily basis. And again, like you said, with carbs comes water, and comes like an inflammatory response to some degree, and just water retention. You're just holding more water. So as soon as you cut the carbs out, you have this compensatory release of a lot of water you were holding. And people are like, wow. And they feel like, you know, your waist goes down, you're like, all your clothes fit a little looser, and you're like, oh my God, this is really working. And that's just the effect of you not being bloated and inflamed. I shouldn't say just. That is the effect of you not being bloated. And then from there, if you can stay in a calorically reduced state, then you're starting to chip away at the body fat and let the body fat burn. Now, you don't have to do a low-carb diet to do that. Just reducing calories in general will cause your water content to go down and your sort of inflammatory response to go down, because you're just putting less in. So it's just that when people – you know, the calories – people just don't like – I don't know why, but they just don't like the calories in, calories out argument. So they'd rather pick on a nutrient like carbs. And then, if that's what floats their boat, then they can go ahead and believe that. But you get the same response if you just eat less food. So, So it's – I mean – and for a lot of people, they drop, like I said, right away when they just have the first – that first initial drop in calories. It's a big deal because they've never experienced it that way before.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Okay, so let's talk about separating signal from noise. We kind of talked about that a little bit, and you know, with this whole water thing, but I think there's a lot more we can talk about in that regard.
Yeah, this is a decent segue. So separating the signal from the noise, the point that means when you're looking for when you're investigating anything scientifically, and just in, you know, just in general in your life, when you're trying to come up with a conclusion on something. The signal is that the actual cause and effect stuff that you're looking for, but the noise is the background fluctuations that are always happening on a regular day-to-day basis. So in the case of water, you and I can jump on the scale this morning and be whatever weight we are, and then by this evening we could be 5 pounds heavier simply because we ate some food and stuff and, you know, had something to drink, and we could be like, oh my God, I gained 5 pounds. And if so that's – we could misinterpret that as a signal, but if we measured ourselves every day for 6 months, and every day we're like, oh, we go up and down 5 pounds just about every day, okay, so that just becomes the background noise. That's just normal fluctuation. So just picture a sine wave, right, like a line waving up and down. If your normal fluctuation is 5 pounds up or down, you're not going to be surprised if one day you happen to measure yourself and you're up or down 5 pounds. You're like, oh, I know that that's normal. It's normal for me to go up and down 5 pounds about every day. Mm-hmm. And that's it. So that's the noise. That's the background noise. That's just what's there. Now, the signal, if you're trying to find an actual change, you need to whatever measurement you're making, it needs to be separated out from that noise. So if you're fluctuating up and down 5 pounds, but then over time, that fluctuation, let's say you used to fluctuate between 185 and 190, and then over 6 months, now you're fluctuating between 175 and 180, that's the true, there's your true signal. You're like, I have actually gone down. But you have to account for the noise. You have to account for the regular fluctuations in your daily routine. It's kind of like all the money that goes in and out of your bank account. And any given day, you're between two certain number values that you're pretty used to. And then it doesn't matter if there's a couple hundred bucks or $1,000 more or less if that's what you're used to, because you're like, oh, that's just the normal fluctuations in my account. You know, whether or not, you know, a car payment or a loan or a mortgage payment's in or out or paychecks in or out, that's just normal. But if it jumps by $10,000 or jumps by $100,000 up or down, you're like, oh, whoa, that's not the noise. That's a signal. Like, that's something real. So there's, I don't know, hopefully both of those analogies give people an idea of the difference between signal and noise. And that's the same thing with the water weight versus are you actually gaining or losing fat mass or actually gaining or losing, quote, muscle mass. You can't just jump on the scale and be like, oh, wow, I did a workout and I'm 5 pounds heavier. That must be all 5 pounds of muscle. Or the reverse, if you just lost 5 pounds over the course of a day, that could easily just be because you haven't eaten much. It doesn't mean you burnt, you know, 5 pounds worth of fat off your body. This is where people get really confused with research, whether or not the research is a true signal or if all they've done is show you what the background noise is and try to make a claim on it. So, for instance, in that interval training study, people didn't lose any weight, and a couple of skin fold measurements seemed to change, but that study never measured those measurements for 6 months before or after that study. That could have easily been normal fluctuations in skin fold measurements. You see what I mean? Mm-hmm. So you measure it and you show a change to people, but if you just measured it for like another 6 months, what if those were just normal fluctuations?
Right.
And then all you've done is focused your looking glass down on one little spot. But if you just expand the view, you'd realize that you've done nothing besides show people just a normal fluctuation.
Right. Let me mention this, talking about signal from noise, because I know we talk about a lot about weight loss, but I want to talk about muscle building a little more to kind of even it out, because you know we've got a lot of guys who are really interested in that as well. And let's talk about signal from noise on bodybuilding style diets. We kind of went low carb and what that does, but traditionally what I've been seeing, just looking at some of these diets, is that they're basically trying to force feed people, at 4,000 to 5,000 calories or more. Typically higher carbs and things like, I'm not going to say higher carbs, but people are eating higher carbs. So after, a week of pounding 4,000 or 5,000 calories, I mean, and so they went up 10 pounds or 15 pounds or something like that. I mean, it's all water, right? I mean, they could be growing a little bit in muscle mass, but just because of the inflammatory response and how much food they're eating plus the water, and because they're not measuring actual muscle, what they've gained, they're measuring, what they're weighing, they're going to make that correlation to say, oh, well, damn, I just gained 15 pounds. That must mean that I just gained 15 pounds of muscle.
Yeah, exactly. So they're retaining more water, both some within and some outside of the muscle cell. Fat mass has some water content to it too, right? So you got to kind of sort of picture your body in three compartments. You've got intramuscular, so inside the muscle cell. You have in between the cells, which is interstitial fluid and area. So like it's not in the muscle cell and it's not in the fat cells either or in your bloodstream. It's in between. And then there's the inside the fat cells themselves. So you can have water in all these areas. So if you overeat, you're going to be kind of increasing water sort of all over systemically. Also inside your gut, if you're constantly eating, your gut itself is going to have more food and more water content in there. So you're just kind of – there's just – on the inside of the mass that makes up your body, there's just a lot more stuff and a lot more water retention. So yeah, you can – unless you can show that all of it was inside the muscle cell, then you're not really gaining muscle as much as you are just becoming bigger on a whole. And yeah, you'll stretch a t-shirt more. You'll be bigger. Like you'll in clothes, you'll look like you take up more space. But out of clothes, you're going to look pretty smooth and you're not going to look all that tight. So, and I'm pretty sure that's not the goal. So that's, we used to say there's a difference between shirt on big and shirt off big. Shirt on big, you can get away with being, relatively smooth and fat. Shirt off big, that don't look so good, and then it comes right down to how lean you are.
Right. Gotcha. So, but you know where I'm going with this, because we get a lot of questions about, having to eat more to gain muscle and stuff like that.
The signal from the noise there is that, you're just making the leap that any extra weight on the scale, you're just trying to tell yourself that it's muscle mass and not just a mix of fat, water, and maybe a bit of muscle growth.
Well, and here's the thing that I guess they can get away with, because they say, hey, you've got, 20 pounds of lean gains, or lean mass gains, or whatever. And hardly anybody says lean muscle gains. They usually say gains in lean mass, or gains in
lean body mass.
Right, lean body mass. And so, but that includes water.
Well, lean body mass includes water and includes internal organs and wherever the water is on your body, just everything that's not fat. If you just drink a glass of water and go back into like a bod pod type body mass analysis machine, it's going to change your lean body mass. If you drink two glasses, it's going to change it again. So that's why I'm saying you have to have consistent results. And not only does your measurement have to be consistent, it also has to be compared to and teased out from normal fluctuations anyways. So like your measurement from this Thursday to next Thursday, it may go up or down. But that doesn't mean if it went up or down that actually means much of anything if you don't have another 20 Thursdays in a row to compare it to see that, oh, yeah, out of 20 Thursdays in a row, doing my normal routine from 1 week to the next, I usually go up, and that measurement will come out a couple pounds one way or the other. So mm-hmm. That's how you know that 2 pounds just means nothing. So this bleeds into the next point of significance. A lot of these research studies in their controlled research environment, when they do certain statistical analysis, they can show you a measurement that clinically, that's statistically significant. Like 1 pound difference by their analysis is significant. But in the real world, it means nothing. It's kind of like that HIIT training study. Like, clinically in their laboratory setting, with the way they jigged the skin fold measurements and divided them by energy expenditure, they came up with a significant result, and that was their 9 times greater fat loss result. But so that was their clinical statistical significance. So let's translate that into the real world. Real world meaning, what do you and I want? To gain muscle and lose fat. Did the people even change at all in body weight? No. Without summing all the skin folds, there was actually no change in muscle mass from one group fat loss from one group to the other either. And then the DEXA, the machine that they used to actually measure lean mass in that study, the fat calipers that they used to measure the skin folds, depending on the error of those, their statistical significance could just disappear based on the error of the calipers. So there's your difference between real world significance versus clinical significance. In 20 weeks, the people were the same weight. So right. that's all that really matters.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's an example of the signal from the noise. Like that, what they were measuring was probably just background noise. It's just normal fluctuations when you use those measuring devices. And a lot of the research that gets quoted in the health and fitness industry is doing this sort of stuff. They're kind of just pointing out like normal fluctuations, and then people don't even realize that was just a normal fluctuation of the body, and then they'll just zero in and measure just a normal fluctuation and point it out to people, and people are like, oh my god, that can change that fast. And they don't get at all that if they'd have bothered to measure themselves for the past month, they would have already known that would change that easily. It's just somebody's calling it to their attention finally. That's all.
You know what we should do? Once we get down to, where we want to be as far as, because you're pretty much almost there and I'm not that far off, but how you've kind of just done the whole weight loss thing, and just basically your proof of concept is that you've been eating pretty much whatever you want to, just less of it, like chicken wings and pizza and all this other stuff, but you still shed like 25 pounds. One of the things that we ought to do maybe in January or February, all of us kind of clean out or whatever, just kind of drop the creatine, just kind of get normalized or whatever. And then, so take maybe 3 weeks to do that. And then for 2 weeks, just pop the creatine back on. So take an initial weight measurement and then picture, then jump on creatine again, and then overeat at like 5,000 to 6,000 calories a day for like a week or two, and then do a weight measurement at the end of that just to see what the fluctuation would be.
Oh, and, yeah, that would be pretty – yeah, yeah. You'd get a dramatic change.
Yeah, and knowing the math, you would know exactly how much fat mass you would put on. I mean, you would probably put on 5 pounds in your fat or something like that. I'm just kind of ballparking it.
Yep.
Just from overall. But you would probably go up – you'd probably go up, I don't know, 15, 20 pounds.
Yep, and it would – me and Pilon actually tried this a long time ago. And after cutting down, we did a big overfeed to see if we could – we were kind of – I don't know, silly. We thought we could elicit an anabolic response by overeating after undereating. Mm-hmm. We were, I don't know, maybe it was our way around just justifying eating like pigs for like 2 weeks. And it was disgusting. We cut down for 8 weeks and we both lost, you know, about 20 pounds in 8 weeks. And then we started overeating. Like you just said, I'd say we were trying to get close to 10,000 calories a day. It was really hard to do. It was pretty gross. I tell this story to one of my students when I was at Florida, and they couldn't believe we were doing this. Like on the way to work, we'd eat like a dozen donuts or a dozen muffins. And then when we got to work, we'd have like a 500 or a 50 gram protein shake, 50 grams of protein, which is like 400 and change calories. And then in between, like this is like 8 a.m., 9 a.m. We've already consumed probably like 2,000 or 3,000 calories. And then while we were at our desks doing work, we'd have a bowl of almonds and craisins, you know, those like mm-hmm. cranberry raisin things. So we'd be snacking on that in between like what we would call a meal. And that – almonds and craisins are like mega calorically dense if you're just pounding them back. And then by like, you know, 10 or 11 a.m., we'd have like a for real full breakfast. And then like at 2 o'clock for lunch, we'd go over and have like lasagna and veal or some kind of like chicken for lunch. So it's by about 3 p.m., we were up 6,000-7,000 calories for the day. And I could only keep this – it was gross, man. I could only keep it up for, I don't know, I think 6 or 7 days. It was so hard to do. And let me tell you, and I don't know if anyone's ever tried this, overeating on purpose is way harder than undereating. It's way easier to go on a diet than it is to force feed yourself. Like just imagine after Thanksgiving dinner, like as full as you are on schedule, force feeding yourself another 2,000 calories. It's just so hard to do. And so, but I mean, and I gained back 19 pounds in like 7 days. And you know, again, now I look back and I'm like, of course I did. That was massive water retention, massive inflammation, you know, some muscle hydration. I'm sure I gained some water in the muscle. But in general, we kind of end up right back where we started. Like we didn't, mm-hmm. we undid 8 weeks of dieting in like 7 days.
Right.
So it's like, you know, I like your idea of actually, we can show this. So I have experience doing it and we can recreate that, but do it all on like in photos or videos so people can actually see. And then by the end of it, you know, once you calculate it all out, that would be – the noise would be our body weight. The signal would be only a pound or two fluctuation in actual fat mass.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, we can do that. That would actually be pretty interesting to show people like how weird that actually – how much your body can change but how little fat mass is actually going up and down and how little muscle mass is actually going up and down underneath it all.
Right. Yeah, that'd be pretty cool. So, all right. So let's get back into some more of the clinical significance versus the real world significance. What are some of the other things that maybe claims that people are seeing out there right now that really, in the grand scheme of things, really don't matter? I mean, testosterone claims. We've talked about that before. You know, growth hormone claims. You know, things like that. I guess.
Yeah, I mean, for muscle builders, you can see supplements that have research, and you know, it's clinically done research that says, you know, 90% increase in testosterone. But when you actually look at the data, all it was even though the way they measured it, it said it is a 90% increase. All it was doing was changing a normal changing from low normal testosterone to high normal, but still within the normal range that you could measure on any group of guys if you just randomly brought them into the lab and measured them. So, like that. You know, all you're going is from normal to normal, right? Because people got to remember that in a human system, it's not fixed. It's not like a brick that's just sitting on – your body's not like a brick that's just sitting on the table and that's it. You can measure all the sides. You can measure its weight and that's all it is. Your system's dynamic and it's things in your body are changing constantly. Like, again, girls will get this. They know when certain hormones are being released higher than others, like through their monthly cycle. But guys are the same way through a daily cycle with testosterone. Testosterone gets released on a pulsatile a pattern. Same with growth hormone. There's certain times of the day where you have more growth hormone than others. So just based on when you choose to measure, your number will look higher or lower. And then, you know, throw in a workout, and that kind of affects how the measurement looks again. And throw in a couple of other things, like eating throws your hormones off a bit again. So without knowing all of the background noise, the background pattern of how things fluctuate, a lot of these measurements can just be an artifact of just setting the study up to show it. So there's, you know, you'll see research saying increase in testosterone or, you know, increase in growth hormone. All they're showing is a normal level changing to a normal level. And then all you do is rejig the numbers so the percent looks huge.
Well, let me ask you this. I want to talk about something about metabolism real quick that just kind of came across. So basically what we're saying is that could this be the same thing, you know, when people are saying if you skip a meal, then your metabolism will drop. Could this be that what they're measuring is the actual stimulus effect of the meal as far as the actual what the metabolic cost of digesting that particular meal would be?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, well, I mean, there's a known phenomenon called the thermic effect of food. Everything your body does has a metabolic cost or an energy cost. Digesting food's no different. So when you absorb and digest food, that costs at least some energy. And so when you eat 1,000, depending on how mixed the meal is and what's in it, you're looking at anywhere between 5 and 10% energy cost of the meal. So if you consumed 1,000 calories, that's roughly on average going to cost your body 100 calories to deal with it. So, but there's still 900 calories that are getting stored, right? So mm-hmm. If you overeat by 1,000 calories thinking that you're somehow stimulating metabolism, you're only stimulating it to the tune of 10% of the calories you ate. So right. The other 900 calories are going to get stored if you're overeating. You see what I mean? So that right. So yeah, like the food, that's what, like, I think people, if you're going to try to find any research at all that indicates eating increases your metabolism, that's it. But yep, it only increases to 10% of the amount of calories you're putting in. So it's impossible to eat your way to weight loss. So that's where I think this whole eating constantly to keep your metabolism up, I think it's that terrible misinterpretation of what it actually is.
Right. So basically, however – and like I say, I'm totally just throwing this out because this is all you. So I'm just kind of postulating right now. So basically, when somebody's going to measure, however they measure, you know, metabolic activity in the body, you know, at rest, they're actually taking into that particular measurement is taking into account the thermic effect of food that person just ate. So there could be, it could show a 100 calorie more, a metabolism increase of 100 calories, but that is only because they just ate and it's actually the body's having to use that much energy to digest the food. So it's not basal that they're really measuring. It's the actual basal plus the thermic effect of the food they just ate, right?
Does that make sense? Sort of, yeah. You kind of mixed up a word there. You can't really say at rest.
Well, not basal, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So you – By definition, when you're doing a basal measurement or an at-rest measurement, you're fasted. So your body's not in a postprandial. Postprandial meaning the state after you've eaten when your body's still dealing with the food. So you're not in that state anymore. You're fasted. So normally it's like after 12 hours or 16 hours, and you're just sort of lying there, and they're just going to do a calculation of how much your energy expenditure and how much energy your body's using up. And then that's your base rate. And then when you can – off of that, you can feed someone and find out, do another measurement and be like, oh, now they're burning even more because they're busy digesting that food. But that's irrelevant because you've also put in this massive amount of calories.
Right.
So you can never eat your way to weight loss. I mean, that doesn't make any sense because you're always putting in more calories than the amount you're burning to digest those calories.
Right.
And it's not even close. It's like way more calories, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I hope everybody's getting what I'm trying to get at, or the question I'm trying to ask and what I'm trying to get you to explain. Because, like I say, I don't know. I just was thinking about it, and maybe people – I know that we hear about this type of thing, and, you know, eating 6 meals a day helps stimulate the metabolism and things like that. And I just kind of wanted to – while we're talking about signal and noise and clinical significance versus real world significance, and just kind of, I know that's a big question that people ask, and so I just kind of thought about it, and I wanted to kind of
Well, yeah, and then it's just a misinterpretation. It's technically accurate to say that eating food does cause some calories to be burnt. It just doesn't cause enough. And it could never cause enough because it's only by definition 5 to 10% of the food eaten, mm-hmm. of the number of calories in the food eaten that it'll actually increase burning. So you could never catch up, right? So it's so that's signal from noise. That's significance versus real-world significance. Yeah, there might be a significant rise in calorie burning, but not compared to the amount of calories just got put in. So, like, who cares? But the misinterpretation of it turns into this nonsense about eating, like, constantly to stimulate metabolism. And how many people have fallen into that trap, and they're just, you know, they can't get out of it, and it's messing up how they eat. And I think eating more often just presents more opportunities to overeat. If you only eat twice a day, and you're kind of paying attention to how many calories you're eating, it's not that hard to miss. If you eat five times a day, now you have five different times you can overeat. Mm-hmm. Like that's way harder to manage, right? Like you're just creating more things to manage or more situations where you could possibly slip up.
Right. So unless you're very meticulous about it, you know, eating 5-6 times a day, unless you're just right on top of it, it could be a recipe for disaster.
And that comes from bodybuilders who eat a ton. The eating 5 meals a day or 6 meals a day comes from bodybuilders who thought that they needed to eat a lot of food to bulk up and were trying to eat 5 or 6,000 calories a day. And they're like, man, this is tough to do in 3 meals. I don't want to eat 2,000 calorie meal. They're huge. They're gross. So for them, when you say it that way, they're eating 1,000 calorie meals 5 times a day. That's way more realistic, right? Mm-hmm. But for somebody who's not a giant bodybuilder trying to bulk up, their meals are going to look tiny. Like for a 5'4" girl, she's going to be down to like 150 calories or 200 calories a meal. She's like, this is terrible. These aren't meals. This isn't fun at all. So when you take it from the people who started it and then try to extrapolate and give it to everybody else, it doesn't make any sense at all.
Right.
And the guys who did it in the first place were erroneously thinking they could eat their way to eat that pattern to either being eat in that pattern to more muscle or to muscle and fat loss at the same time because of the pattern they're eating or something like that. So they're already overeating, and then since overeating is so difficult in 2 meals, they just spread it out over 5, and then all of a sudden everyone who saw them on the cover of magazine was like, well, that guy eats 5 times a day, so I should too. And that's, right. You know, it's no different than the misinterpretation of exercise. Like people, you know, because I always say it's just calories in, calories out, and then but then right after that I say you can't out-train a bad diet, so people think I'm a hypocrite or think I'm missing the point or I'm contradicting myself. Because they're like, well, if it's only calories in, calories out, can't you create a calorie deficit with exercise? And of course you can. I mean, exercise burns more calories than not exercise. I mean, I've never disputed that. That's obvious. But with more there's a few caveats that you and I have discussed before, and it's, I don't know, maybe people keep missing it. Exercise almost always brings with it an increase in calorie consumption when you're not paying attention. So unless you're strictly controlling your diet, you'll almost always eat more on days you exercise more. Plus, you may rest more throughout the day and be less active. Now, that's another thing people just aren't paying attention to. So all things being equal, if you controlled for diet and controlled for rest and throughout the rest of your day, then yes, you could actually create a caloric deficit that would cause weight loss purely with exercise. But now, this is the clinical versus real-world significance. Clinically, that makes sense. In the real world, that's never been shown to actually work, because even when you put two groups on a diet, but one group adds exercise, they still don't lose any weight. So they don't lose any more weight than the diet-only group. So they either end up cheating on the diet, which is probably exactly what's going on, or they take more rest throughout the day. But either way, the extra exercise did them no extra good for weight loss. So it's – I mean, and that's been shown multiple times, repeatable in the research. So you just can't fix more with more. You can't eat more and then just think you can exercise more to overcompensate for the eating more. And that's been shown pretty conclusively in the research. So there's nowhere else to really go with that. So you I mean, if you control for everything and you have your diet like pinpointed right on the button with the number of calories you're eating in a day, yeah, you can create an even bigger deficit by exercising, but you really have to pay attention to your activity level throughout the day besides that exercise. And on top of that, most people grossly overestimate how many calories they're burning during exercise. Like, mm-hmm. cardio machines are way off the ones you see in a local gym, and people just think they're doing more exercise than they really are. And the more efficient you get, the less calories you burn, like all that kind of stuff, right? And another mm-hmm. one, no one ever considers this. When a machine or when you read a book or look at a textbook and get like a rough idea of how many calories a particular quote exercise burns. So let's say you're doing some sort of machine and it says that, you know, you burnt 200 calories that hour on that machine. And let's say it's even accurate. That's 200. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean you've burned 200 extra calories. That means you burned 200 calories minus the number of calories you would have burnt for that hour anyways. You see what I mean?
Hmm.
Like while you're alive and just sitting around doing nothing, you're going to burn – this is your base amount of ball. Great. You're going to burn, you know, 40, 50 calories an hour. If you go do an exercise that says by definition in a textbook that, oh, you know, during an hour of this exercise, 200 calories get burnt. That's not 200 plus the 40. That's not 240. That's 200 minus the 40. So you've only created an extra 160 calories burned. See what I mean? And no one ever thinks about that. So couple that with a slight error of the machine, with a slight maybe a couple extra bites of food overeating throughout the day that you would never even notice because they can show people can't even remember what they ate a day ago, and then a little bit of extra rest, that 160 calories vanishes.
Right. Yeah. I can see that now. It's really interesting, you know, a lot of the stuff that we get into as far as, you know, all of it. I'm talking about, I mean, we're even talking correlations and causation, and we haven't got into that. And, you know, the exercise stuff has really been opening up a bunch of people's eyes. Let me tell you kind of what I've been thinking about as we've been going through these things nowadays about exercise. And I don't know, maybe you're kind of on the same level, but nowadays I'm kind of more along the lines of exercise should, I'm not going to say should only, but let's just say it like this. Exercise should only be done to increase the performance of your body in some way, shape, or form. That's the ultimate goal of exercise.
As compared to what?
Compared to the way a lot of people are thinking about it, like saying I'm exercising for weight loss, and so they're measuring, or, you know what I'm saying? It's like I'm exercising for weight loss, but it's kind of a moot point. And so if you're exercising, this is just kind of how I'm thinking about it in my
head.
If
no, I agree with you. Yeah, use it to increase a parameter like increased muscle strength and increased muscle mass at some point, you know, which is usually preceded by strength.
Mm-hmm.
Functional ability. If there's something that you're having trouble doing, like there, you know, maybe you have a recreational sport you play and you'd like to be a little bit better at something. Yeah, you can do that. Or just posture, things like that. It just makes you feel better, right?
Right.
And yeah, exercise, and it improves all kinds of measurable parameters of health. So look at all of those things, but don't look for exercise to be a solution to weight loss or fat loss.
Right. But what I'm getting at is that for any type of exercise, there needs to be, if you're, I'm not going to say if you're doing it right, but to be most effective for your life, there needs to be a performance-based goal that you're going after. You know what I mean?
Well, I guess performance based was one way of looking at it. It's hard to look at it as a, that would be another way of measuring how you're improving. If you can go with a muscle gaining goal too, if that's part of how you're trying to use your exercise to influence your body. I think the way to look at it is there's only certain, so I think people think it can do more than it can.
Mm-hmm.
And the one big thing that I think they're making the mistake is assuming it can cause significant weight loss without any change in diet, or that it can have some weird effect on your metabolism that just can't.
Right. So I guess what I'm just for myself right now, and you know, I'm kind of talking to you about this, just kind of things I'm thinking about for myself. But like, so just like in weight training, there is, you know, it's progressive resistance is what builds muscle. It's the progressive training, progressive resistance, and increasing. And so the same thing for cardio and things like that for people that, you know, for myself, instead of getting on the machine and saying I'm going to run for 20 minutes or whatever, if running is my thing, I should really, what I should be doing is saying, okay, I'm going to run for 20 minutes, get a baseline, and then the next time I get on the same machine, I should have a goal of going farther and faster than I did the last time or the last week at this time. So having an actual progressive, you know, increase in performance for that particular activity as well. Same thing with maybe walking or whatever, if that's what you're doing and it's not a leisure activity. Like I say, I'm just kind of painting this thing out in my head.
And that's a good way. That's a good way to teach people how to, because people want to know, want to measure stuff. Muscle growth happens really slow. So it happens so slow, it's hard to measure. So, and people get discouraged psychologically if they don't see something changing. So yeah, a performance-based change is your more short-term goal-oriented way to measure progress. And then over time, the muscle gain, you know, the muscle size will happen. Same thing with, you know, overall health parameters. If you have your performance parameters are your more short-term and psychologically and real-world satisfying results that you can see in much shorter time frames compared to the overall change it has on your body over time. Mm-hmm. Like if you just set the goal, I'm going to try to gain 5 pounds in 2 years of muscle. How do you even start measuring that? You just wait till 2 years and see if you get on the scale? Like that's ridiculous.
Right.
But if you have all of those other performance changes along the way, you're stronger, you've got more endurance, you know, you're stronger in a bunch of lifts, and you know, some body measurements over time have gone up, then you've got a realistic way of measuring it. So yeah, you're right. The performance goal is your simplest and most realistic way to set yourself up psychologically for a way to track your progress.
Right.
And not get discouraged. Like that actually makes a lot of sense. It's easy too. Like that's a really easy way to measure stuff.
Right. So you could measure all the other parameters and stuff, but you know, just using a performance based goal, you know, from 1 week to the next or whatever, you can actually, if you track that, it's kind of like in the last email I put out, it's like, just like we talked about, it's like our programs and systems are designed to make people more attractive basically. But the funny thing about it is that all of the, in the process of becoming more attractive using our systems, all the health parameters that everybody, that are the goals or the primary goals of other programs, are being taken care of in the same regard.
Oh, it's so, not, they're not mutually exclusive.
Right.
It's like we said, a good looking body is a healthy body. There's just kind of no way around that.
Right. So, and same thing with like the performance-based goals is that when you're shooting for a performance-based type goal with your exercise, all of these other auxiliary or things that people want health-wise are pulled into the realm as well. You know what I'm saying?
Like we just had this discussion in the forum. So with our measurement system, right, like with the Adonis Index measurement,
mm-hmm.
like I had a question in the forum about, well, so then if all guys at the same height have more or less the same ideal shoulder-to-waist ratio, and if strength is correlated to muscle size, would they all be roughly the same strength? And my answer was yes. More or less, all the guys, a bunch of guys that are 6 feet tall who are closing in on or at their Adonis Index ratio, height and weight, height, waist, and shoulder, like it all works out. They're going, and given the same number of years of training experience, you're basically going to be very similar in strength and endurance to that other guy. Just mm-hmm. because that the look and shape of that body at the right index ratio can't, there's a certain type of amount of training and work that needs to go into getting it into that shape. And so you're going to be very similar in strength to the other guy who's also in that shape.
Right.
It's kind of like, you know, all football players in a similar position across a given league will have very similar like strength measurements. They'll be within 5 or 10 pounds of each other. They're going to, you know, they'll squat the same. They'll run about the same speed. They'll have about the same, you know, and then you take all the guys, you know, so all the running backs will be similar, all the wide receivers. Within reason, there'll be a mean that they all bunch around. They'll all kind of come out pretty similar.
Right. Yeah, which makes sense because, you know, you and I talk about it all the time, even in some of the coaching calls and I think maybe some of the earlier podcasts, but we're roughly the same size and we lift roughly the same. Obviously, you're probably going to lift more in certain things. I'll probably lift more in certain things. But that's also based on how our body is shaped too. But we both have roughly the same AI. You know, yours is a little bit better than mine because your waist is a little better right now. But you know what I'm saying? We've talked about this stuff before. It makes
right. Sense. And then if you took 100 guys, the numbers wouldn't – the difference between you and I wouldn't be significant at all, because if we took 100 guys at our size and measured, we'd all be within 5 or 10 pounds of each other on almost every lift.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just it. And then guys who are significantly weaker would probably have a significantly smaller shoulder measurement and would need to build themselves up. But by the time they got up to us, they'd be right back in lifting the same as us. So I don't people don't want to believe that they're that measurable or something. I think – there's something going on with people where they think they're like snowflakes, like they think they're special, and they don't like the idea that we're all like really, really measurable, and that our system is very mechanically can be broken down to its parts, and that we're not just the sum of our parts, but that's really what we are. Mm-hmm. So, and then once you can accept that, you can just accept the fact that, oh yeah, everything's pretty much measurable. And it doesn't mean you and I don't look totally different. Like, even though our shoulder measurements are really similar, just the way the muscle hangs on you, and just slight variations in muscle belly thickness and length, and the way bone structure just slightly changes, almost every person looks relatively different from the next person over, even though their measurement's identical. Just the slope of your shoulders, the way your traps hang, just how you fit together, just everyone looks a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
So you're still special. Everyone's still a snowflake.
Right. You're still a snowflake, but all the snowflakes the same size.
Yeah. But every single snowflake's the same size and made out of the same stuff.
Yeah, exactly. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So, all right, I know you wanted to talk about Pareto a little bit in regards to clinical significance, real-world significance, and maybe some separating signal from noise. I guess, you know, let's finish off with that because, you know, we don't want to go too far.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I mean, we're beating the hell out of all of this. So as a kind of a take-home message, all of this, like, clinical versus real-world significance and separating the signal from the noise, like all of this stuff, with the way research works in the whole diet and fitness industry, there's certain like immutable rules that just don't change. Like weight loss is about a calorie deficit. However you feel like creating a calorie deficit, whether or not you want to eat enough to get to your BMR and then try to exercise away the rest, which we already know is like super hard to do, or you use a diet strategy. It doesn't matter what the strategy is. You got to eat less. So this is the Pareto principle, the 80-20 rule. Like, you know, 80% of your results come from 20% of your effort. And the diet and fitness industry is splitting hairs and picking apart all of these different, you know, diet things and like ways to exercise and this HIIT versus steady state. None of that's really the heavy lifting. All of the heavy lifting, at least for weight loss, just comes from the calorie deficit. Whether or not there's like a specific way of eating that might be slightly better than another, or a type of exercise that might burn a couple calories here and there, that's the minutia. That's not where, you know, you can spend 80% of your time worrying about that, reading about it, trying all different routines, but the thing that's really going to cause the result is just eating less. And so
right.
That's the heavy lifting happens with one simple step. And then I guess the 80-20 thing is you could spend 80% of your time on stuff that's only producing 20% of the results, or you could, you know, just eat less. And that's where all of it's happening, just in that one little push or that one little focus.
Yeah. That's interesting, because I want you to talk about something in that regard as well, because when people, you know, are talking about all the minutia and the things and the ways to be able to do it, you know, from my point of view, and this is what I want you to talk about for a second, all that stuff and the ways of eating, it's not necessarily which one's the best as far as which one does the best, I guess, mechanically, as it is which one fits your lifestyle the best, which one's the easiest for you to stick to and things like that. And I guess what I want you to talk about, even though that, I mean, you're with Pilon and all this, and you do a lot of talk about fasting a lot and how it's easy. You really haven't done any fasting on this weight loss thing that you've been doing. And you were telling me because you've just gotten a good routine and you don't want to monk it up, right?
Yeah, no, during my cutdown, I haven't done what I would call a traditional eat, stop, eat style of fast. I haven't chosen my 2 days a week the way I would normally do and chunk out a 24-hour period. No, through my whole cut down, I eat routinely throughout the day, but I don't eat much at all. It's just routinely. So I typically get up and have a coffee and a sweet is what I call it. So it's typically a coffee and like a tea biscuit or a donut or a muffin or something like that. And then, you know, at some other point in the day, I'll have another sort of coffee sweet thing. And then at another point in the day, I'll have some kind of fruit or vegetable meal. And then maybe later on another fruit or vegetable thing. And there's some, you know, some protein mixed in there with the fruit vegetable, like some sort of chicken or meat. And that's it. So I'm consuming three or four times a day. So that wouldn't be, and I do that pretty much throughout the week. So there's no eat, stop, eat style in there, at least for this cut down. When I'm back on maintenance, I'll probably do eat, stop, eat again. But it was my eat, stop, eat patterns of learning that meal timing is, you know, doesn't matter. That you can just go however many hours you feel like without food. It was the eat, stop, eat pattern that taught me that you can just manipulate however you want, whenever you want, what you want. So eating, without going through an eat, stop, eat pattern, I think it would be hard for me to learn that this pattern is just totally acceptable to do. There's like a level of psychological freedom to it. You're like, you know, if I miss one of those things, it's like, who cares? You know, if I eat an extra one, it's like, you know, it's not that big a deal. It's, you know, it comes down to the calories, and then I can always offset, a larger meal with an actual fast if I want to. And so sometimes I don't really measure it, but sometimes I actually go 16 hours without eating just because that's just the way the days work out. I'm not doing it on purpose. It's just sort of how stuff lands. And without going through eat, stop, eat, I may be worried about that. Or I could see how people would have been. I would have been personally before I, because I've been doing eat, stop, eat style fasting for like 3 years. So it's not new to me anymore. But before I was like, man, can you really do that? And I'm looking back now going, I can't believe I thought I couldn't. But you know, just today I was having a coffee and the people behind me in line were looking at the menu. They were going to get a coffee and I overheard one of them say, well, are you going to get anything with your coffee? And the other person was like, well, yeah, we're not eating till 5 o'clock. And it was noon when we were standing there. So these people, it was a big deal for them to make it 5 hours without eating something. And I'm sitting there looking at them going, it's been 16 hours since I've eaten. And I'm almost feeling I might as well just push it to the 20 point. And these people are worried about five. So it just goes to show you how far off people are or how ingrained it's gotten into people's minds about this constantly eating thing. And so now when I look back, and you're right, Brad, you're correct that I don't do an eat, stop, eat style fast, but I think during this cut down, I take longer gaps between eating than anybody around me ever does. Like it's routine for me to go 12 to 16 hours without eating, even during this cut down. And that's because the night before I probably stop eating a little bit sooner than the average person would. And the next day I don't start till a bit later. So it's easy for me to have anywhere between a 12 and 16 hour gap almost every day. But right. I bet you most people don't go 8 to 10 hours without eating. Including sleep, like the meal before bed and the meal right when they wake up.
Right. But the takeaway, talk about the burrito, about the whole thing is that even though you have all this knowledge about different ways to do it, you finally you just settled into a way that you got into a rhythm with.
Oh and yeah. During the week, my routine is it's very routine. Like my routine is that's. Yeah,
there you go.
I apologize for how dumb that sounded. No, yeah, my eating pattern is very routine. It's very predictable what I'm going to do from about Monday to Friday. And then on the weekends, it changes, but the weekend itself is also predictable. And then and it works for me. I'm down almost 30 pounds now. So why would I change anything?
Right. Yep.
Yep. So, yeah,
that's all I was saying, talking about Pareto principle and – yeah. People worried about the minutiae. It's not necessarily which one mechanically works better, you know, for fat loss from, you know, clinical significance, you know, getting into the real world significance for you as a person, which one of these styles is easiest for you to stick with. And
once
you get something you're sticking on, no matter what anybody says, which works better or whatever, I mean, if you're on it and you've got a rhythm going, who cares?
Oh, yeah. Do not listen to anybody telling you that there's a way to do this. It's just the one rule. Okay, just for weight loss, the one rule is find a way to eat less. But it's completely up to you to find a way to do it. Like people probably people won't even believe what I eat. They just won't. Like it just sounds so wrong to what the dogma is. Like I literally have a couple of coffees a day and always something with chocolate. And it's usually like just, it's like a donut or a croissant or a muffin or something like really sweet, like one of those, you know, those fruit bars that Starbucks has. Like it's nothing you would think is what would be typically on a weight loss routine, I guess you could say. And I do that like twice a day. And then later in the day, I'll have some kind of salad and that's it. And, you know, I can't imagine anyone would actually argue with me that it didn't work, considering I'm 30 pounds lighter. It clearly works. So it's up to you to find a way. So for me, I'm perfectly happy eating that way. And then on the weekends, it's pretty low protein throughout the week, which I couldn't care less about because I don't believe that we need any significant amount of protein either. More at least the way we're being taught. And then on the weekends, I have a lot more protein, and I'll just kind of eat whatever. I'll go out to the bar with my buddies and watch football and stuff, and have like significantly higher calories, plus more protein, plus more everything. And then I'm just right back down to my routine during the week. And so for me, that's exactly what works. And there's no reason I would change one little thing. So I don't follow any rules about meal timing. I don't follow any rules about macronutrient profiles. Like any rule, I bet you I break every single rule of dieting you can even imagine. Like there's just not one thing that the current dieting dogma preaches that I would do. I seem to do them all wrong. Like it's it's high carb, high sugar during the week. Then it's like high protein, high fat, high carb on the weekends. Now that's percentage wise. Total calories is low. Mm-hmm. And I don't follow any kind of meal timing ritual. I just sort of eat whenever it fits. So the only thing I'm doing consistently is eating less food.
Right.
Which is the signal from the noise. Less food is always what's working. How you go about getting less food is completely up to you.
Right. So Dave, so that's Pareto on that end. I think you're probably going to touch on something else real quick, maybe muscle building or something.
Oh, well, I mean, there's so many different things we can get into right now. I don't think we really need to go anywhere else with this. I think we've kind of landed in a good spot for. I don't know. What do you think? Do you think we've covered what we needed to cover?
Yeah, I think we've kind of got into it. I mean, I'm not going to say we've debunked a lot of stuff, but we've definitely given a lot of people a lot of things to think about in regards to what is being what they're being told as far as muscle building and for weight loss, what's working, what's not, percentages. Basically going back from this podcast to the last podcast and to even the one before that when we started talking about a lot of this type of stuff. You know, and when talking about signal from noise and the transient up and down responses, the inflammation of food and water content and what that can do to your body based on what you're eating, drinking, and things like that, and how it has basically no basis on what's really going on as far as fat loss and muscle gain. I think that's pretty strong. I mean, you've obviously proven the fact that you can lose weight and do basically whatever you want to as long as you eat less. So that's proof in pudding right now. And then obviously once you get there and once I get there and we want to do this other little experiment when we go up, you know, for a muscle building type of thing and just kind of demonstrate that as well, we can do that. And I think that people will get a lot out of it. So
yeah, and I guess the take home message is realize that when you see any of these claims in this kind of industry, think in your head. Clinical significance versus real world. Like, is the number they're telling me, the some percentage, okay, great, it sounds fancy, but does that really mean anything? Like, is anything going to change on me in the real world, like in my life? Separating signal from noise, whatever they're talking about, is that just a normal fluctuation in a normal human body from day to day anyways? And if that's just a normal fluctuation, who cares? And a lot of things that you're going to see a lot of claims, they're doing is pointing out a normal fluctuation but making it sound dramatic. And I guess the other thing that we never really touched on, but as a take-home note, whenever someone brings up one particular study, and I know last week we deconstructed one study just to show you all the inconsistencies and how easy it is to misinterpret a study, one study is never the answer in any particular field of research, whether it's health and fitness, in any field of research. You always have to look at the body of evidence. Like, what do all the studies in that field say? And if all of the studies are weighted more or less in one direction or support one opinion more than the other, then that is your best – that's your best bet that that's more what's going on than not. If one study says it's red and then 30 studies say it's blue, it's probably blue. But if a bunch of marketers are just marketing the one study that says it's red, and you don't realize there's 30 others that say it's blue, you could totally be had thinking it's red all the way. Mm-hmm. So that's your last little note of when, you know, unless you're very aware of a body of research and all of the research that goes into it and where it is at so far, one study basically is you can't take it for what it, you can't take it to mean anything until you've seen all the other studies that go with it.
Right. I think that's about it, man. I don't know if we've got anything else. We've kind of, I think we've kind of hammered this one home again. So good job.
Yeah, man. That one's dead.
Cool, man. Well, guys, once again, like I said, if you like what you're hearing, you want to go ahead and invest in our stuff, it's AdonisIndexSystems.com. You can go in and check out the systems and all that good jazz and, you know, meet up with us in the forums, ask questions, and get some good stuff. But other than that, I am Brad Howard, John Barbin. Thanks again, buddy.
No problem.
All right. We'll chat at you later.